Welcome to the CCA edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the cholangiocarcinoma community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're talking today with Dr. Juan Vaide, Chief Medical Officer of the Cholangiocarcinoma Foundation, a new position that took effect August 1st. Before this appointment, Dr. Vaide, who is originally from Peru, spent 23 years as a clinician at the Christie NHS Foundation Trust and as a professor at the University of Manchester, England, where he currently resides. Dr. Vaide is an expert at treating cancers of the liver, pancreas, and biliary tract, as well as neuroendocrine tumors. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation to come and speak about this excellent topic.
Sure. So your appointment as the Chief Medical Officer of the Cholangiocarcinoma Foundation marks, in essence, a new chapter for the foundation, which has never had a Chief Medical Officer. Can you explain the purpose of this appointment and what it means for the foundation and for the patients that you assist?
So over the past 10 years or so, the foundation has gradually been growing and expanding. I've been involved with the foundation since 2015 when I attended their annual meeting. And it impressed me very early on how engaged they were with patients and caregivers, but also the passion that they had to grow in terms of interaction with clinicians, industry, regulatory agencies, such that the foundation has now grown in size, but also in terms of reach, very much becoming an established international foundation, which is being recognized by clinicians like myself who are interested in cholangiocarcinoma, both in Europe, in the US, but also further than that in Asia, South America, and Africa.
Well, we understand that the incidence of cholangiocarcinoma is also rising. Can you explain why?
Yes, so the observation has been something that's consistent across different parts of the world, not just in the US, but has also been seen in Europe, and appears to be largely driven by patients with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. So that means cholangiocarcinomas that arise within the body of the liver itself. That may in part be to better recognition, it may in part be to better coding, but it's also likely that there is a true rise because we know that there is an increase in liver disease as a result of things like lifestyle. So, for example, being overweight, lack of exercise, things like that appear to be increasing the incidence.
What about smoking? Is that a risk factor?
It's not a strong risk factor, but I think is linked to other lifestyle factors, like I've already mentioned, so they're probably all related. Sometimes it can be a little bit difficult to tease out the relative contribution of each individual lifestyle factor.
And what about the alcohol consumption?
So cholangiocarcinoma is more frequent where there is liver disease. Now, liver disease is a very broad term. Sometimes we use the word cirrhosis, which means very heavy scarring of the liver, and many things can result in that liver disease. Sometimes it's inflammatory conditions like primary sclerosing cholangitis. Sometimes it can be hepatitis, so that can be a viral hepatitis, VOC. But alcohol also can cause cirrhosis, and we know that that is a risk factor for cholangiocarcinoma.
And to a lesser extent, I imagine that genetics may also play a role, particularly those with certain mutations such as the BRCA mutation, correct?
Yes, so we are seeing these. We're not seeing very strong trends as we are seeing some other cancers, but we do find that there are some patients who have a BRCA mutation. And if that happens, then of course we need to try and understand whether this is an inherited mutation, a germline mutation, or whether it's a mutation that's just arisen in the cancer itself, so-called a somatic mutation.
So we also understand that liver fluke in Southeast Asia is a big factor, which accounts for the fact that Thailand has the world's highest rate of cholangiocarcinoma, correct?
Correct. And the high incidence that we see in Thailand, but it's also the adjacent countries like Laos and Vietnam, is very much to do with exposure to a liver fluke, which arises as a result of contaminated food. So effectively, although we call it raw fish, it's more of a fish tartare. So it's fish that's mixed with herbs and spices. And the problem is that that then causes the liver fluke to infect people's liver. And doesn't cause a cholangiocarcinoma straight away. The infection needs to be present for 20, 30 years, and then the cholangiocarcinoma develops.
I see. In the United States, cholangiocarcinoma seems to be on the rise, but we were recently at the 25th World Congress on Gastrointestinal Cancer in Barcelona. And we understand that Spain, Italy, France has also seen some rise, and particularly among younger patients. Why is that?
I think one of the things that's happened in the past is that there's been an under diagnosis or under recognition, I should say, where sometimes, as you know, we may see cancer in the liver, and sometimes the assumption is that this cancer has come from somewhere else, so-called a second cancer of unknown primary. But increasingly now we're recognizing that in fact it may well be a primary cancer starting within the liver, a cholangiocarcinoma. And so we know that maybe up to 1 in 9 people with cancer of unknown primary, so it was thought to be cancer that spread to the liver from somewhere else, may in fact have a cholangiocarcinoma. So that increase in recognition is key. Why we're seeing more young people, that's difficult to be completely sure as to what the etiology is for that. What we are seeing is that there are patients who do have established liver disease like primary sclerosing cholangitis. We also know it's more common in conditions like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, and sometimes it's those associations that we see it arising in younger people.
How strong is that association with inflammatory bowel disease such as ulcerative colitis? Is there a strong link?
So the vast majority of people who have ulcerative colitis will not develop a cholangiocarcinoma. Okay, I think it's important to say that. But we do know that with ulcerative colitis, you also get a chronic inflammation within the liver, and a small proportion of those patients will develop a cholangiocarcinoma. So it's a very clear established link, although thankfully the vast majority of people will not develop a cholangiocarcinoma.
Now, the fact that you are chief medical officer of this important foundation, how will this translate into actually helping either with research or clinicians or patients themselves? How does this translate into benefits for those who have the disease?
Yes, so one of the reasons that I came onto the cholangiocarcinoma is that my values very much align with the core values of the foundation. So I've always been very much for patients first, a very patient-centered activity. You will see from all the clinical research that I've been involved with that I'm a collaborative person. We do need innovation, and we need to do that quickly because this is a cancer which is very much of unmet need. So I'm hoping that with my appointment, we'll be able to accelerate some of the developments, making sure that the foundation is a global resource for patients, for caregivers, for investigators, for industry, for regulatory authorities, but also to be able to drive some of the changes that we are seeing coming through some of the clinical research, but making sure that that's then implemented within daily clinical practice.
I see. Very interesting. Cholangiocarcinoma holds, the foundation holds a conference every year in Salt Lake City, right?
That's correct.
Yes. And obviously because of COVID, this was done remotely for several years, and now you're back to full swing meetings. Has the pandemic in any way affected patients with cholangiocarcinoma?
So insofar as it affected everybody, I think there were concerns initially about the increased risk of patients, particularly patients receiving chemotherapy and possibly contracting COVID. As time went on, we realized that in fact, that was less of a concern. And the main problem that patients had with COVID was an overstimulation of the immune system. And sometimes that was dampened down with some of the treatments that we use. But I think it also led to problems with accessibility to diagnostic imaging appointments, visiting hospitals, all of which closed down to a degree during the pandemic. It's good to see that things are now pretty much back to normal. There are some things that the pandemic has taught us, which we may keep. And that, for example, is the use of telemedicine, where we don't necessarily have to bring patients up to the clinic in person. We can do this in a more patient-friendly way by seeing them in their homes through telemedicine.
So I wanted to get to the therapies themselves. Despite progress over the years, the prognosis for people with cholangiocarcinoma still is pretty bad. From what I understand, we're looking at lower than a 10% 5-year survival rate. Is that the case?
Yes. So I think other cancers, which are much more common, have been able to accelerate some of those developments. I think there's a couple of things that we need to bear in mind. And unfortunately, most patients that are diagnosed with a cholangiocarcinoma are diagnosed at a stage that is already advanced. So we're having to manage advanced disease. Only about 10 to 15% of patients present early enough to be able to have potentially curative surgery and adjuvant treatment. Where we have seen major developments over the past few years have been in the identification of molecular subgroups of patients for whom there are specific therapies, and even more recently, the emergence of immunotherapy as a new modality of treatment for these patients. Now, obviously, the test ground, as it were, is in patients who do have advanced disease, and we're trying to understand more about the biology and who benefits. But I think where we're really going to make big inroads is, as you say, much earlier in screening, prevention, early detection, surgery, and the use of adjuvant treatment. So we're hoping that by focusing on those and understanding the disease better, we can really shift that dial for the 10-year survival.
I wanted to ask, the fact that the foundation now is a chief medical officer, do you think that this will help spur clinical trials and funding for trials that can help patients in the end?
Yeah, so when I started doing clinical trials over 20 years ago, there was very little interest from industry. And I remember writing many letters of intent to pharmaceutical industries. And consistently, the reply was along the lines of, this is not within our strategic development. It's refreshing now to see many industry partners developing their practice-changing, phase three trials. And not just that, but engaging with the community to see how these treatments can then be implemented and where do we go next in terms of, rational combinations of treatments, using the treatments in earlier stages of disease, for example. So we are in a time where there is a lot of collaboration, a lot of interest, both from investigators, but also from industry, and that's very rewarding.
Good to know. Dr. Valle, we're just about out of time. I appreciate you speaking with us today. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Larry. Really appreciate it.
This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.